monitoring on day zero or day one, those values there, they're not actually linked to, we've looked at the data on this, they're not linked to inflammation. So a cow that has metritis, her blood calcium is going to be the same on day zero, day one as a cow without. Versus if you start looking at days two, three, and four, particularly three and four, that's where you're going to see a difference. Cows with metritis or some other inflammatory condition, their blood calcium is going to be lower than a healthy cow. And so it becomes a different story of what you're looking at. What's the driving factor behind that calcium? So both of those values, say at day zero or day one and day three or day four, they're both critical values and understanding, but I think they point to different things as far as what's really underlying problems that you may be seeing in the herd.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Did you know that beta-carotene deficiency can affect fertility rates and reproductive performance? Victus Transition from DSM Firmenich provides beta-carotene to help your cattle fertility rates. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd.
Hello and welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. Today I'm very happy to welcome to the show a friend and colleague, Dr. Corwin Nelson. Corwin, thanks for joining today.
Yes, thank you, Barry. Glad to be here.
Corwin's an associate professor in animal science at the University of Florida. And has a pretty neat path to how he got here in the first place. Corwin, where'd you grow up? Did you grow up on a farm?
Yes, I grew up on a dairy farm in East Central Minnesota, just north of Minneapolis, about an hour and a half.
And you've migrated to Florida, so you apparently didn't love the winters.
I probably enjoyed it at the time. I went further north up to Duluth for my undergraduate in biochemistry. I did my bachelor's there. And then south to Ames, Iowa, which, you know, south from Minnesota anyways, to Ames, Iowa for my PhD in biochemistry. And I thought that was warming up quite a bit, just moving from Duluth down to Ames. That was a big warm up.
Yeah,
and then Wisconsin for my postdoc. And then ended up down here in Florida for a faculty position 12 years ago now. So it was, quite the change that way. I would have never imagined, and, you know, my wife and I, you know, before graduate school and all that, we never would have imagined that was going to be the case. In fact, when we got married, my plan was to be a dairy farmer, not going into academia the way it was, but you never know where your path may take you.
Well, and one thing people don't necessarily understand outside of academia, it's not like you just put your finger on the map and choose where to go. If you want to be in academia, there's not 1,000 choices at any given time, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's especially if you're, you know, say dairy science, working on that, there's not many places that you really have good opportunities to be able to be successful in that. So,
well, one thing I really respect about you, Corwin, is having grown up on a farm, you totally can have conversations about applied dairy management. And I know you're the faculty kind of in charge now of the University of Florida Dairy Farm, which maybe we can get into if we have time. But like you said, you did your PhD in biochemistry, so you can go as applied as anybody wants to and about as basic as anybody wants to. So it makes you an outstanding resource, I think, for the topics we're going to cover today.
Yeah, thank you. It makes it fun. It's useful to help be relatable to the dairy farmer in the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
Typical fresh cow incidence of clinical hypocalcemia is 3-6%, while subclinical hypocalcemia affects 50% or more mature cows. Based on cutting-edge research, Exelite offers a new approach that is build effective and easy to use. For more information, visit www.protecta.com.
So what we want to tackle today is hypocalcemia. And I know that, you know, this podcast alone has done numerous episodes on this, but at least from my vantage point, I only really, track this tangentially. you know, maybe 10 years ago, I kind of thought we were at a stable point in this topic. And man, so much new information and new tools in the last 10 years, it's a pretty interesting area now. So maybe let's start with what we knew 10 years ago. Like, why does hypocalcemia occur? What is hypocalcemia? When is it the biggest issue and why does it occur?
Yeah, you bring up a good point there, Barry. And when I was in graduate school, so I started in 2006 and I was at the National Animal Disease Center. It was the Periparturient Diseases Group with Ron Hurst and Jesse Goff, Tim Reinhart. They did a lot of work on hypocalcemia. Those are some of the guys that are very well known in that. And so the interesting thing is when I started, there was very little interest in hypocalcemia. They still had a very much of an interest, but from an industry's perspective, and even from the upper administration in the USDA, it was, hey, milk fever solved. We don't got to worry about this. Let's move on to something else. So when I started my graduate work, we weren't doing anything on hypocalcemia at the time. I got into this more from I worked on vitamin D, but the role of vitamin D in the immune system. I barely even studied the role of vitamin D in calcium homeostasis, other than kind of on the periphery to understand that its overall function. But there just wasn't the focus on hypocalcemia at the time. But one of the big, shifts in that, there's a few of them, I guess. One is a paper in 2011 published by this group, Tim Reinhart was one of them. So it's one you oftentimes see cited, subclinical hypocalcemia in dairy cows by Tim Reinhart and several of the other colleagues there, Jesse Goff and Ron Hurst there at the USDA. And it highlighted the prevalence of subclinical hypocalcemia in dairy cows. So even though these cows don't have clinical milk fever, they still have serum calcium concentrations would fall below it. And then they came up with a threshold, I think, in that one was a 2 millimolar of 8 milligrams per deciliter for serum calcium. And so that sparked this interest. Well, how much of it and if impact is there of subclinical hypocalcemia and health disorders? One of my colleagues here, Jose Santos, he and his group of students did another paper that was, I think, published in 2012. Natalia Martinez was the first author on that. And she looked at the relationship between subclinical hypocalcemia and postpartum health disorders in cows, and then did some work with calcium boluses too. And there's work linking hypocalcemia to other health disorders and that, but that was one of the also significant papers showing the association between subclinical hypocalcemia and impaired health. And so that that really got this field revived again, a lot of interest. Well, we got to focus on subclinical hypocalcemia. And so, there's quite a bit of work then for the next, several years going back to DCAD, working on that, just experiments at looking at the effects of DCAD again and really getting into that. Around 2017, another publication came out, or a series of publications from Jessica McCart's group at Cornell. They started looking at, well, not all subclinical hypocalcemia is the same. They've been looking at different thresholds in that. But then they realized, well, you have a subclinical hypocalcemia, but then you have something called transient or delayed and persistent hypocalcemia. And now they call it dyscalcemia, I think, is the name that they've termed it, which is maybe an appropriate name there to really emphasize it. It's not a normal calcium status of a high-producing, healthy dairy cow. So that's kind of shifted where the field is today now. There's a lot of things that we're just now starting to understand about really what's going on in terms of hypocalcemia. And it's not all the same. As we're getting into here today.
Absolutely. So let's dig into that. So I guess big picture, I'd say still, it's more or less true that very few farms have major problems with milk fever like we would have had 30 or 40 years ago, right? So that sort of, overwhelming, annoying, frustrating factor is kind of taken care of on most farms. But again, we still have this evidence of subclinical issues that are probably linked to negative outcomes later on. But now we're learning more about that hypocalcemia may not be as simple as huge calcium outflows out of the mammary gland, right? And the body trying to keep up. Are there other things that can drive some of that dyscalcemia, if you want to use that term?
Yeah, definitely. And to your point there early about the milk fever, yeah, it's common that it's going to be under 2%, 1% the milk fever. In fact, you might hear a dairy farmer call up his nutrition and say, hey, I got a problem with milk fevers now. And, well, it's one case, right? You have one case of milk fever and all of a sudden they're on high alert of what's going on. It's milk fever per se has really been prevented. Now, because it's there can be issues with management of pre-fresh rations and that can lead to all of a sudden there's an incident coming up that are more cases of milk fever it'll all of a sudden occur. So going back to the question though on what are those, why is hypocalcemia occurring in hypocalcemia? Why is that occurring? And that's the principal driver there is that irreversible loss of calcium to the mammary gland at the onset of lactation. I mean, that is the major driver. And you just look at the calcium economy, that's what's driving it. And why does that matter? It's blood calcium is our body's calcium has to be tightly controlled because of the intracellular functions of calcium and its role in cell signaling. So you think of other metabolites or minerals that are tightly controlled. Probably the most tightly controlled I can think of in the body anyway is pH. That has to be the most tightly controlled. If there's any deviation there, you're going to end up dead very quickly. Sodium and potassium chloride, they're all tightly controlled. Calcium is another one of those. It has to be tightly controlled. So, and you see that very quickly in a cow that develops milk fever, that has milk fevers because that blood calcium has dropped too far and she'll become paretic or have paralysis very quickly if not taken care of, or lead to death if ultimately if not taken care of. So the driving factor behind that is milk production. That calcium going to the milk. However, we've learned that that's not the only thing that can be driving that. So part of this change here is what we've learned, that inflammation does cause some hypocalcemia. So if you take an animal outside of the transition period and do it, and Lance Baumgartner's group has done this, I've done this work too, and you've probably done these endotoxin challenge, LPS endotoxin challenge. Well, blood calcium decreases during those endotoxin challenges. Not to the extent that you're going to see from at the onset of lactation, right? And there's a very good paper from Jesse Goff did this. I think it was 2006 it was published. Maybe it's before that. I'm blanking on the year right now. But they did mastectomies on cows and showed that if you take away the udder, there's no hypocalcemia. Now, that was a very good foundational study showing it's the mammary gland is the main driver. But we also know that inflammation is another source of that hypocalcemia. Another one that probably gets overlooked too, that it's not the source of the hypocalcemia, but probably prolongs it, is the ruminal stasis. So when that rumen is not functioning, if you don't have flow of nutrients from the rumen through the intestines, well, then you're not going to have absorption of that calcium. Right, so if that cow is not ruminating, that can delay it or prolong that hypocalcemia. So there's a couple factors there, which really become hard to tease out what's driving what there, because if a cow is sick, she has metritis, well, she's not going to eat as much. Right? Her ruminations go down. So is it the inflammation that's causing that delaying that return to normal calcium status, or is it the because the cow's not ruminating? It's really difficult to tease those out, but we know they all drive it, right? And I think that the critical thing that we're finding there is one of the driving factors behind this is inflammation that's associated with most prominently metritis. That is driving that delayed hypocalcemia that we see.
Okay, so given that extra complexity, and I like how you characterize that, you have sort of this mountain the cow has to climb in terms of calcium drawdown, and then there's some other factors that can exacerbate, right, how hard that is for her to overcome that. So thinking about that and thinking about the sort of characterization of some transient versus delayed hypocalcemia, I know this is something we've struggled with at our research dairy. How do we approach monitoring blood calcium in fresh cows now?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. I think the part of it, it's what are you trying to answer then too? So I think if you're looking at, is it a question of, is the pre-fresh ration working as it should be? Is it preventing a milk fever? So if it's working as it should be, that calcium on day zero or day one, you're not going to be seeing a milk fever there. So that's indicating that your pre-fresh ration is working as it should be. Now, I don't think we've really settled on what is that critical threshold for serum calcium or plasma calcium on day zero or day one. We know that if a cow develops milk fever, that's bad. Now, what we don't really know, there's a lot of associations out there, but we don't really know is, you have, say, a plasma calcium below 1.9. Is that really bad for that animal? Because we have data showing from a large study that we did where cows that were below 1.9, they're the highest producing cows in the herd. You know, as long as they didn't develop any disease, they're a healthy, high producing cow. So there's the real possibility because of calcium is involved in the immune system plus other critical functions, say at ruminal function and neural function and muscle function, that low calcium does put a cow at greater risk, right? But I wouldn't say that we've really nailed down what that critical threshold is, because we also know that, yeah, cows that are very high producing cows, they can have low calcium, and somehow or another they turn out to be at high performing cows. So that's one part of it is monitoring on day zero or day one. Those values there, they're not actually linked to, we've looked at the data on this, they're not linked to inflammation. So a cow that has metritis, her blood calcium is going to be the same on day zero, day one as a cow without. Versus if you start looking at days two, three, and four, particularly three and four, that's where you're going to see a difference. Cows with metritis or some other inflammatory condition, their blood calcium is going to be lower than a healthy cow. And so it becomes a different story of what you're looking at. What's the driving factor behind that calcium? So both of those values, say at day zero or day one and day three or day four, they're both critical values and understanding, but I think they point to different things as far as what's really underlying problems that you may be seeing in the herd.
Well said. Yeah, and almost need to put them in different buckets in terms of, you know, do we need to counteract this, first of all? And if we do, how do you approach it, right? Because I think they're, like you said, different problems, really.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Then the question becomes, what do you do about those? I think we know on the prevention of milk fever side of it, on those day zero, day one, if they're, say, you have a threshold that you're targeting there to keep your blood calcium above on day zero or day one, and whatever it is in your pre-fresh ration that you're managing there to keep it above that level, we know we can work on that one. The other more challenging question that I guess those that have an interest in immunology like we do, that becomes the fun part there of how do we handle those cows that it appears to be an inflammatory disease that's driving that, then how do we handle those cows? There's part of it you're looking at, well, how do we need to manage or feed those cows in the prepartum to help prevent that? Or vice versa, I guess if you're more of the veterinarian approach, how do we treat that condition, right? So on farm when you see that condition, because you're still going to have it. How do we treat that condition? And that's, you know, that's still an ongoing area of research. You've done plenty of work on the inflammatory, anti-inflammatory treatments, and you know what really works, what doesn't work there. And I think there's some things that we found that just simple anti-inflammatory doesn't always just help a cow. That inflammatory response is needed. So we have to. It's not just a simple, hey, we use some sort of anti-inflammatory to solve that issue. It's got to be shown to be effective.
So let's go over maybe the easier part of that, which is the preventative strategies. And I wanted to make sure we spent some time on, you know, reconsidering the tools that are out there for prepartum, you know, pre-fresh tools. And then also maybe quickly we could touch on boluses or other calcium supply strategies post-calving. So talk me through what are my options if I'm a dairy producer and I need to implement a pre-fresh strategy to prevent milk fever at least.
Well, the tried and true most commonly used method out there now has been the low or negative DCAD. Ian Lean at over in Australia, he's the one that reminded me from one of his papers or meta-analysis they did. He goes, it doesn't have to be negative. The data showed it doesn't have to be negative. It's a low or a negative DCAD in the pre-fresh ration. And so that's certainly been shown to be effective. And there's a couple of very good meta-analyses that were done, published in 2019, one by my colleague Jose Santos and Ian Lean. And then Ian Lean had another one too. They just used different approaches in the meta-analyses, but they had 42 different experiments that were analyzed there. And certainly they showed what we know is a lower negative DCAD prevents milk fever, prevents hypocalcemia. I think importantly, what they also found in there is it's not only prevention of that disease, there is improved productive performance and improved health. So they found that a negative versus a positive DCAD resulted in more milk, 2.6 pounds, I believe, on average, in the following lactation. Fewer cases of metritis, fewer cases of retained placenta. And that was some critical findings for that. And also gives a lot of evidence to this this point of, does hypocalcemia lead to subsequent disease?
Right. Is it a cause or just a marker? Right.
Yeah. Right. So it's more complicated and nuanced than that, but it does give some good evidence to, hey, if we prevent hypocalcemia from a lower negative DCAD, we do see less disease. And so presumably it's through the actions of in part from the actions of calcium in the immune system taking place there. It's likely more things than that, but that's certainly a plausible explanation. So, yeah. So that's one part. We know that lower negative DCAD will prevent hypocalcemia. Now, what we've gotten into is seeing that it's that delayed or chronic hypocalcemia. That's another point we can get to here in a little bit later of what works there. So the other one that I guess historically has been used quite a bit would be the calcium boluses, right? So that's been used for quite some time, and they have a place at preventing milk fever. Now, the health outcomes, that's another story that we can get to here in a second. But certainly, if you got an issue of milk fever, the calcium boluses are an effective strategy to help with that. The one that's become more prominent now here in the last 3 or 4 years and really starting to take off is the binders. Originally called them calcium binders, the zeolite A. It's those they called it a calcium binder. Well, they found also that it is actually also binding phosphorus. And there's some work out of Germany showing that low phosphorus diets resulted in better prepartum low phosphorus diets resulted in better postpartum calcium. All right, so that made this link then of, well, how are these binders really working? The zeolite A, how's that really working? And that's in part through binding that phosphorus that's in the diet, and so bringing it, creating that, I'd say it as pseudo phosphorus, a pseudo low phosphorus diet because it's binding up that. So, and those have, there's not nearly as many experiments, published experiments on there out there, but those that have been done show it's effective at preventing hypocalcemia, or I should say clinical hypocalcemia. And from what I've heard out in the field, yeah, it's been very effective that way too. And the nutritionists that are working with it, the ones I've talked to anyways, seem to be very happy with it. I still have some questions about it as far as, and that's in part because the research isn't there to the extent that it is on the low or negative DCAT. It's just, it took many years of research to gather enough on the DCAT to be able to show ultimately its effects on health performance. We just, the body of research isn't out there yet on the zeolite products, but from what I've heard, and I mean, it's taken, there's a lot more farms that are switching over to it because not that it doesn't have to be managed as tightly, but I think the feedback that I'm getting is it's not as variable as what you may find in a DCAT. I want to stress the point. It still has to be managed, and I think that's what they're finding is you still have to manage it closely, but you may not have quite the variability they might see with a DCAT and struggle to manage it quite as well, or dependent on the rations that you have for implementing a low DCAT.
Even just taking away measuring urine pH as a weekly chore on these farms that are so strapped for labor is a selling point for some people.
I think an important point that they can't get away from, though, is the measuring that you're or doing the analysis on your pre-fresh ingredients. So knowing how much phosphorus, potassium, calcium is in that diet, you still got to keep potassium low as possible. That we've known for a long time. Keep that potassium low. And then the other is it paying attention to that phosphorus level. So talking with some nutritionists up in Vermont where they actually have to limit dietary phosphorus up there because of the phosphorus restrictions, they realize, well, hey, if we implement this just without doing some sort of titration of that zeolite product in their pre-fresh ration, well, then they really may be restricting phosphorus too far.
Yeah, so and spending too much on zeolite as well.
Oh, right? Yeah, spending it. So, and that is, I think, a shift that's now taking place in the last couple of years is doing a titration of that product according to the amount of phosphorus that's in that ration.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Our Yeast 40 ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergen Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Priority IAC, a company founded by Richard Brunig, acting president. The only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Priority selects specific strains of smart bacteria to provide the best performance in animals and combines this with a unique approach to nutrition. Visit us at World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin, September 30th through October 3rd. You can find us in the Coliseum on the main floor next to the West Side entrance, booths 18 and 19, and learn how Priority is helping to improve animal health, one herd at a time.
Okay, fascinating. Well, we could dig into this a lot more, I'm sure, but we should probably move on to our three famous questions. All right, so first of all, I know you're a reader. What's your favorite dairy-related book or resource within our field?
I think when I've been on here before, I said Journal of Dairy Science, which I certainly like and enjoy. But I think part of the other part that I really like, and more so because I like to hear from the other side, like it's fun to read the science and all that, but I like to know what's going on in the industry. So any of the industry related publications, so Dairy Herd Management, Progressive Dairy, Hordes, all of those, and then say that like the daily newsletters that come out, just updated on where the markets are at, things that are happening in the industry. Those are, I find, very helpful to just stay in touch with what's going on out there. Otherwise, it's so easy to get just kind of caught up in the world here of science and lose track of what's going on out there in the industry and what problems that everybody else is facing.
Well said. All right. What about your favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
The other one that I read most often, and this doesn't sound pious or anything, but the Bible, right? It's a very fundamental part of my life and what I do, and it shows me how I need to live, right? And not from a religious or a rule standpoint, but the essence of what's embodied there, of just having integrity of what I do, how I treat other people, how I interact with others, and all those. It shows me how I need to live and sets that standard that way. So that's really the favorite resource there, the one I go to most often, not anything else. So
just wisdom, right? Yeah.
Yes, wisdom, plenty of that. And certainly with raising kids too, a lot of wisdom there about how to do that.
Makes the job at work seem easy sometimes.
It helps me keep my patience too and keep a right perspective on life.
Great answer. All right. Well, you can throw us a different answer if you want this time, but how would you say a successful dairy professional stands apart from those who are less successful?
Yeah, and I think this would still be true of certain those that really pay attention to the details or just really stay on top of things, right? They know that. That's certainly true. But I think one that I've thought of over time too, and just recognized over time, is those that are willing to look to the future. You know, they're future oriented with what they do. Obviously not too far in the future to lose track of what needs to be done today, but they also have an eye to the future, saying we need to plan for our business to go this way in the future. So and making those changes appropriately, or having a plan going forward to that and being able to adjust as things come about. So statistics would say that, well, it's just getting larger, right? You know, going larger, because that's what we always see. But certainly there's dairies that can remain successful by staying at a similar size, but they have to have a plan of how they're going to do that and remain successful in today's world when everything, you know, just going larger is more efficient. It doesn't mean that you have to, but you have to have a plan of how you're going to do that to be successful. So you got to be innovative in what you're going to do and have a plan, come up with a plan of being able to do it, not be afraid to try new things.
Well, Corwin, thanks again so much for another fun conversation, hopefully very informative for the audience.
All right, thank you.
So again, our guest today has been Dr. Corwin Nelson from the University of Florida. And this has been another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. If you haven't followed or liked the show, make sure you hit the button so you don't miss the next episode. And until next time, this is Barry Bradford signing off.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.